大的招待券，也就是然后三年开完年，学生过年。
The former team was expounded in the spiritual parts of the two vehicles of the hearers and the solitary realizers. This was expressed in the corpus of the low vehicle teachings for the benefit of those belonging to those categories. The theme of the latter involves the causal relationship between the great vehicle teachings in the general discourses and the secret teachings of the Tantra. Therefore, those who are fortunate are explained the teachings on the practice for cultivating the awakening mind, which is the entrance to wisdom, enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. It is the entrance into the practices of the great vehicle and the means for attaining the fully awakened state of the complete omniscience. So when it says here for those who are fortunate, means that everybody who claims to be a Buddhist practitioner or follower probably cannot follow all these teachings. So the fortunate people are those who are not lost with temporary pursuits, who have farsightedness, and who have long-term vision to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. So therefore, it is not the case that all the followers of the Buddha are able to follow the Bodhisattvayana path. And that is why in the text here it says, here, for those who are fortunate, are explained the teachings on the practice for cultivating the awakening mind. It is the entrance into the practices of the great vehicle or Mahayana. It is called great vehicle because it is great in terms of the path and also in terms of the result. Moreover, all the teachings of the and it is the entrance into the practices of the great vehicle and the means for attaining the fully awakened state of complete omniscience. Moreover, all the teachings of the Buddha, the transcendent subduer, pertaining to activating the awakening mind or bodhicitta, are found in three systems introduced by the great pioneers. As I explained earlier, the process of developing bodhicitta through the seven force effect instruction, and then there is the system of development of bodhicitta through the practice of exchange of oneself for others. And then you have the profound view that came through Nagarjuna and so on. So these are the three systems. And all these are sacred. And ultimately, supreme spiritual nectar, capable of revealing the non-abiding state, transcending sorrow, the nirvana, which destroys the 84,000 kinds of disturbing emotions and their creations, even all such misery as birth, aging, sickness, and death. In general, the term nectar in the text refers to the elixir, which provides immortality. So nectar, the state of nectar here refers to the state of nirvana. So it is here just as a proficient doctor when diagnosing an illness prescribes a medicine that can relieve the patient of his sickness and even prevent his death. So the Perfection of Wisdom Sutras tell of the finest type of medicine, even the smell of which is said to drive away the most poisonous snakes. These teachings constitute the universal panacea that can provide true immortality. So by developing the intention to realize the attainments of the hearers and the solitary realizers, we can familiarize ourselves with all aspects of that spiritual path, which can result in the attainment of the state free from birth, aging, sickness, and death. Yet, developing the intention to realize the unsurpassable, fully awakened state of being, the ultimate goal of existence, together with total acquaintance with the entire scope of its spiritual path, can result in the omniscient state of full enlightenment, the state of one who has gone beyond to thusness, the state of Tathagata. And this is the point of complete cessation of every disturbing emotions which even the worthy saints, the rahats among the hearers and solitary realizers, and even the great bodhisattvas and the bodhisattvas on the pure stages have not completely eliminated. So it is in this way that when you achieve the high state of enlightenment, then you have received all the disturbing negative forces like ignorance and the mental emotions, negative mental emotions, and the debt. So all these have been removed at the state of Buddhahood. The precious awakening mind is the supreme essence of any spiritual endeavor, and actually providing the state of immortality. The state of immortality here refers to a state of total liberation from samsara, from cycle of existence. And so there are two types of nirvana. One is nirvana in the form of having achieved nirvana just for oneself, and another is called non-abiding nirvana, which is the state of achievement of enlightenment or omniscience. And once one achieves such a state of omniscience, then one has fully removed all types of afflictive emotions and actualized all the positive qualities. And the main cause for achieving such a state of Buddhahood or omniscience is not simply gaining insight into the view of emptiness, but the development of bodhicitta or altruistic wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. And it is because of that here in the text it says the precious awakening mind is the supreme essence of any spiritual endeavor, the nectar providing the state of immortality. The exalted Buddhist saint from Sumatra was a man who held the lineages of the complete spiritual systems of the great pioneers such as Nagarjuna, Asanga, and Shantideva, much like the point of confluence of three great rivers. He imparted these teachings to the great Indian pundit Atisha in a way that was like the filling of one vase from another that was identical. Atisha had innumerable disciples from India, Kashmir, origin Nepal and Tibet, all of whom were scholars and accomplished meditators. From among them all, it was the Tibetan Dongtrenpa, also known as Jalwen Dungme, and who was proficient to Atisha before he went to Tibet by his divine ally, the goddess Aryatara, who became the major holder of his spiritual lineages, extending the noble deeds of the master to a multitude of followers throughout the centuries. Dongtrenpa had as many realized disciples as the population of the land of origin, northwest of Rading, and in after passing away of Atisha, Dongtrenpa, as he was proficient, established the seat of the Kadampa practice in Rading, and he had many disciples. And in particular, there were the three noble brothers, Potowa, Pichungwa, and Chengawa, who elucidated his teachings in an unbroken transmission of whispered instruction, through which they imparted the very essence of their master's words. And Potowa was particularly famous for his meditation on emptiness, and he himself had boasted his practice by saying that the light by which I dispel darkness is meditation on impermanence. And Chengawa was particularly famous for his practice of development of bodhicitta through the practice of exchange of oneself for others. The most renowned of these three was the spiritual friend Rishi Potowa, an incarnation of Buddha's disciple, the exalted elder Angaja, one of the 16 Arhats, receiving the entire scriptural teaching and hidden verbal transmission of both sutra and chanta from Dongtrenpa. Potowa was very successful in his religious activity, and he undertook a thorough study of and then taught the six original scriptures, which are ornament for the great vehicle, sutras by Asanga. Then spiritual stages of Bodhisattva by Asanga, birth stories by Aryasura, special verses collected by topics compiled by Dharma Trata, compendium of trainings, and guide to the Bodhisattvas we applied by Shantidevas. And in the Kadamba tradition, they have one tradition which is called tradition that primarily follows the scriptures, the texts. And we have the teaching transmission of Shiksha Samuchya and Bodhisattva. And I have not received the transmission of spiritual stages of Bodhisattva. And I have oral transmission of the five texts of Maitreya, therefore I have the oral transmission of Ornament of the Great Vehicle by Maitreya, and I'm fortunate that I'm able to restore the transmission of Shiksha Samuchya or Compendium of Trainings. And he fulfilled his faith in the Buddha by maintaining the precious jewels of the awakening mind at the very heart of his practice, teaching about it and putting it into practice. He had over 2,000 disciples involved in the pursuit of liberation. That means this is a very important remark. He's saying that he had over 2,000 disciples all involved in the pursuit of liberation, meaning that he did not have followers who were trying to get some offering or resting their time in the monastery, but who were involved in the pursuit of liberation. From among those, the most prominent were Lang and Nyu from Nyam. Lang is the Charawa Yontin Lodu, Nyu Trokowa, and they were from a place called Nyam. Nyu is Trakorwa. And then from Thang, place called Thang, he had these two prominent disciples, Ram and Ramdingawa, Jungni Dorje, and Nang. Nang Ishijalchen. And then from Kham he had Cha and Phak, Cha Thakwadorje, and Phak. Thakmarwa, it was his name. And then from the place called Tolpo, there is Be and Ro, Be Mombuchowa. And then Rog Mashurwa, that was their name. That is actually Gishi Tolpowa. And then from the central province, the two Sun and Moon, who are known as Lang and Shar, they were compared to Sun and Moon. Lang, the first two, Lang Ritambo Dorje Singhi, and Shar Sharawa Yundetrak. Lang Ritambo was the one, as you know, who composed the advances of mind training. So Lang and Shar, whose fame was equal to the Sun and Moon in the central province of Yuzhang. And then we have Geshe Trapa and Geshe in Dingpa. Geshe in Dingpa is the Shang Dingpa Shirab Gyansu. And Takar Geshe Trakarwa is out of them, the great Shangtong Sharawa received the entire teaching, both scriptural and verbal, and was considered the one responsible for maintaining the transmission of his master's deeds. He conducted many discourses on the six original scriptures and other teachings, speaking to around 2,800 monks. His most outstanding disciples were popularly known as the four chosen sons. Chulung Kushik was responsible for willing service. The great Tabkawa was responsible for explaining the teaching. And then Nyelmel Duvan Zimba was responsible for blessing and inspiring the holders of monastic discipline, and the great Chekhova was to be responsible for translating the teachings on the awakening mind. The great Geshe Chekhova was first received such teachings from Nyelcha Shingwa on the advantages of training the mind, a text by Langri Thangwa. And Sharava was actually Sharava, about which we read, was a great scholar, and the great translator Nasulotsava has translated the text of Madhyamika Avatara. And Sharava was such a great scholar that when he was asked to proofread a particular translation, he would just read it and he would say, I do see some unevenness or uneasiness at this point, so you must correct it and reread it and compare it with the original Indian text. So when Pasablosava, he was a great translator, and we, after translating certain texts, when he would consult the translation of the commentary of the Madhyamika Avatara to Sharava, he will be able to help pinpoint the shortcomings. And as you know, Madhyamika Avatara is a text which very clearly explains the thought of Nagarjuna. When Atisha, at the time of Atisha, I think in Tibet, the Tibetans regarded the Umanangwa Madhyamika Aloka as one of the most important Madhyamika texts, and it seems Madhyamika Avatara was not so well known at that time. And then Atisha, as he says in his Lamb of the Path, he primarily follows the Chandrakirti's commentary, but in terms of actual study, they were not so known in Tibet. Then it was at the time of Sharava that this new translation of the Madhyamika Avatara came into being, and then it was at that time that this Madhyamika Avatara commentary started flourishing in Tibet. And again, this system degenerated. Then one of the four tutors of Atisha at the time of Rendawa, again the study of Madhyamika got revived. And in fact, there was a saying or statement saying that when you go meditate on, study Madhyamika, reflect on Madhyamika, when you sleep, meditate on Madhyamika. Out of many disciples of Sharava, the man was Geshe Chekhova, and the great Geshe Chekhova first received such teachings from Nyelcha Shingwa. And in fact, his name Chekhova, the word Che refers to cemetery. So he was a great meditator, undertaking all his meditation in visiting different cemeteries. So it is from there he got his name, Chekhova. So he was meditator of the cemetery. So since he was a practitioner who meditates on visiting various cemeteries, he's called Chekhova. And he was also a great scholar, even though we do not have much access to his texts. But if you read the text called Losang Gungyen, it clearly says Chekhova studied more than 100 important texts. He was therefore a great scholar. So this Geshe Chekhova for to receive such teachings from Nyingchab Shingpa. Gyushi Shikawa received such teachings from Nyingchab Shingpa on the advice of turning the mind. Affected by language karma, he said the effects of arousing his faith and interest in the Kadampa teachings, and he said out to Vasa with the intention of speaking teaching on mind training in greater detail. Some of his worthy friends suggested that since the master of the great vehicle should be high in the esteem of others, like the sun and moon, it would be best for him to approach the great Sharava and Chayulva directly. Accordingly, he went to the house of Shol in Lhasa, where Sharava was staying. In a place called Maldro, and in a house called Shol, in Lhasa, Sharava, great master Sharava, was staying there. He was giving teachings, so he went to receive teachings from him. It was a practice of the past great masters that they would not just rush to any particular teaching. They would be very careful to whom they were, from whom they were receiving the teaching. It is said that Chekhava did not go to receive teaching from Sharava immediately. And in fact, he said it took him nearly a year staying and watching from a distance and finding out what kind of teaching he was giving. So he spent around 1 year quite close to where Sharava was living. When he arrived, the master Sharava was teaching about the spiritual levels of the low vehicles hearers. After listening to him, however, Chekhava felt no inspiration at all, and instead became despondent and confused. Of course, as an important philosophical text, it could be explained in a very profound way, but did not inspire him much, so he became kind of confused and despondent, and did not encourage him much, so it was not so particularly inspiring. And In despair, he resigned himself to fulfilling his quest elsewhere. If, when asked directly, Sharava revealed that he did not hold the teachings of teachings on mind training, or that they could not be taken to heart in practice. One day, while a lunch offering had been made to the monastery community, and while the master Sharava alone was circumambulating the stupa, because all his students had gone, I probably it was a teaching break. So he alone was circumambulating the stupa, the liquid monuments to the Buddha mind. Chekhava approached him, spreading a cloth on a prominent ledge. He said, "Will you please sit down? I have something I would like to discuss with you." And then this great master, Sharan,
Sharan,
Master replied, what is it that you haven't understood? I made everything absolutely clear when I sat on the religious throne. So what is it that you want to discuss with me? Chagava then produced the 8 verses for training the mind by Lagritaba and said, I was wondering whether you hold the tradition of this teaching. I have found that it often helps my useless self just a little when all my thoughts run wild, or in times of hardship when I am unable to find shelter, or when I am scorned or cast out by others. Yet I also find that there seem to be a few occasions when it is not so appropriate to practice. Therefore, I humbly ask you whether it is really worth putting into practice or not. Will the final result of such practice be actually to lead one to the fully evident state or not? So he was really asking a very pertinent question that we all do have such difficulties in terms of undertaking actual practice. He said that when I meditate on these advices of turning the mind, it proves very useful when I encounter certain misfortunes, like when your mind becomes wild, or when you encounter hardships, not being able to find shelter, or when you are scorned or cast out by others. So in those cases, this practice is helpful to me. But there are also other occasions when it is not so appropriate to practice. Therefore, I am humbly asking you whether it's really worth putting into practice or not. And the final result of such practice is actually to lead one to the fully awakened state of the Lord. Then the Vishishara was first, who first completed counting the round of his Bodhisattva rosary. I can imagine he must be having a very old, smelly, dark colored rosary. So he first completed counting the round of the rosary before rolling it up, then composing himself and preparing his reply, said, "Hey teacher, there is no question whether this practice is appropriate or not. If you have no desire for the one only state of fully awakened being, you can leave it aside. However, should you yearn for such a state, it is impossible to attain it without directly entering this spiritual path." So he answered by saying that you as a great teacher, it's totally out of question to say whether such practice is suitable to you or not. And he is saying that if you don't want enlightenment, then it's a totally different question. If you want enlightenment, then this practice of bodhicitta is something that is absolutely necessary. And he does have a very decisive answer. Shekhar thought, "Very well, as this is a Buddhist tradition, I am interested to know where the definitive reference for this practice and experience may be found. Since a religious quotation requires a spiritual reference, do you recollect where it might be? What is the source of such teachings?" So basically he is asking, what is the source of such teachings? Because all the teachings should have their source of the teaching of the Guru or other great Indian masters. Then Sharawa answered by saying, without hesitation, he said, "Would not recognize it as from the impeccable work of the truly exalted master Nagarjuna." And he was saying that who is there who will not regard Nagarjuna as an authentic master? And if this is the case, then such teaching comes from Nagarjuna's text called Precious Garland, which is a text full of advice from the king. where it says, so in this text called Krishna's development, it says, may all the evil experiences of others be brought on me, and may all my virtue be good for others. And when Sharava answered in this way, then Chikava developed great hate to Sharava, and then he said, "Oh, gentle sir, I have such deep faith in that teaching. Please, out of your kindness, take me under your guidance." The master replied, "Then try to stir the conditions of your will sustain you." So you are saying that it is not enough that you stay here a short time and then go away, but you should be able to continue and stay with me. Then I can give experiential commentary and you can reflect on it. So that's why he was saying that you should be able to stay here for a long time. Then I will instill genuine confidence in you. Chekhava then asked, if this is the case, then why didn't you give even the slightest hint of this teaching to the assembly in your discourse before? To which the master responded, there was no point in telling them of it. They are not really able to appreciate the full value of this teaching and training. If there is nobody to practice, what is the fun of making such a display of the teaching? But unfortunately, this is absolutely true. And unfortunately, these days, people do not pay much attention about such profound practices. And everybody rushes up in name and pen, and after making three prostrations, Chekhava departed and sought out the exact words in a copy of precious garland, which he found among his landlord's scriptures. Chekhava departed and sought out the text, exact words in a copy of the precious garland which he found among his landlord's scriptures. Then, relying completely on the precious garland, he spent the next 2 years at the house of Sho, during which he dedicated himself completely to the text, to the exclusion of all others. In this way, he perceived the nature of evidence as Arjuna had described as, such that his creation of conceptual thoughts decreased. He then spent 6 years at Jibo and 4 years at Sharva. Altogether, he spent 14 years at the feet of his master Sharava, asking, making himself familiar with the teaching and gaining spiritual purification. Once this experience had arisen, he said that it was so worthwhile that even if he had to sell all his land and get him for gold to pay for the teaching, it would not have mattered. Nor would he have minded being forced to sleep in the mud of the stables in order to receive them. The great Chekhava's disciples included over 900 monks. So it seems Chekhava had some property. So he said it was worthwhile that even if he had to sell all his land and cattle for gold to pay for the teaching. nor would he have minded being forced to submit into the mark of the servants, meaning that even if he had to lead a very poor kind of life and undertake a lot of hardships for that of Christ, he wouldn't mind. This great master Chekha was had disciples included over 900 monks who were devoted to the cause of liberation. Among them was the yogi Chang Singh of Dorsa, the meditator and Zhang Yi from Vansara, Gyanbatun of Palam, the all-knowing master Lova, Japan Sathangpa, the great teacher Rambal Handingpa, the only good master Yalvasi, and many others who became both spiritual protectors and refuge for vast number of beings. In particular, Sichilu spent 21 years at his son, just like Bodhi and the Sheru, during which time he received the entire transmission of scriptural and oral teaching in such a way that he acquired a complete understanding such of the contents of one was had been poured out to fill another just like it. And this process of categorizing the mind training into 7 points is done by Sichilbu. Sichilbu gave the teaching on cultivating the awakening mind to Pachyambo Logavantu, his nephew, and others from whom the lineage descends. Even though I do not remember all the successive masters, but the great Bodhisattva Ngulchi Thongme Sangbo was one of the lineage holders of Sichilbu. And he, in fact, I think, written a commentary on 7 points of mind training. And I hope somebody has the lineage or oral transmission. I had the great fortune to receive the complete transmission of the teachings from the great spiritual being possessing inconceivable compassion and power, Shakya Sonam Gyaltsen Pel Sangbo. And he also says he received the lineage of Rambal Handingpa and the great explanation of the 7 point mind training by the great hero and bodhisattva of these degenerate times, the son of the conqueror Thongme Sangbo, from his disciple, the great translator Jabchok Pel Sangbo. Jabchok Pel Sangbo was the one who has requested Tsongkhapa to write the great stories of the path. I received nothing but 7 points in the form of experiential explanation. And from Thongme Sangbo received the teaching by Rendawa, and then from Rendawa, the teaching was received by Atisha. So I received the landing by 7 points in the form of an experiential explanation from the supreme navigator and protector of this world and the gods, the emanation of Manjushri, the eastern, the omniscient Sankhava, who said that the many individual lineages attending the awakening mind of the great pioneers, this tradition of Chekhava seems to be an instruction derived from the exalted Shantideva's text. Therefore, it must be explained according to that. So, saying that this explanation is based on Shantideva's instruction, which highlights the practice of the Buddha Bodhisattva to exchange oneself for others. And there seems to be a variation in the length and the sequence of the text. So, if it were explained in good order, it would be an instruction that pleases the wise. I shall therefore explain it accordingly. The unique features, value and extraordinary taking of this secret instruction, so that others may come to respect and appreciate this oral teaching, let me comment it, pointing out some of its unique features. So at this point we switch on to the other text, the Bodhicharya Avatara. As I said, I received, I first received the commentary of Bodhicharya at Bodh Gaya, the holy place, from the Red Kinori Lama Tenzin Gyaltsen. He received the teaching from about from Dzogchen Master from Kham, whose name, even though I have written it somewhere, I do not remember it now. And that tradition actually is the tradition coming from Zapetul Rinpoche, and Zapetul was well recognized both the sadhwa and had actually developed both the siddha in his mind, and he was a great scholar and a great practitioner, and he used to teach both the Sriyantara repeatedly, and he was a great practitioner of the Dzogchen, and he was kind of the main, one of the lineage holders of Bodhisattva practice, and he was the master who had disciples from all the four Buddhist schools of tradition, and among his disciples there were many great scholars who were also geshes, like Minyak Kunsu was one of them. He was a great geshe, and he received many texts, commentary of many texts, including the Bodhicharyatara, and he was able to develop experiences on altruism from the instructions and blessings of the great master and the Peltur. And he had written an exceptionally wonderful commentary, and I will base my commentary primarily on this great commentary. And as I said, there were many commentaries on Bodhicharyatara in all the four schools of tradition. Then Nyingma, in the Nyingma school, there is one commentary of Bodhicharyatara also. So there are so many commentaries. And as I said earlier, that all the great masters belonging to all the four Tibetan Buddhist schools and thought, they all highly value and appreciate these texts of Bodhicharyatara. So this tradition that I'm explaining is the Dzogchen tradition. So this is one tradition. Another tradition is the one that comes from Utang, the central province. The throne holder, in one retreat place, he gave a commentary of this text, and at that time, Trishma Rinpoche had received it, and I think Rizu Rinpoche also had received it from it. So this lineage is the lineage coming from Dundup Tundu. Dundup Tundu was in fact one of the Ganden throne holders. When I was a young boy, I think he was at that time Shangchen Chuji. And I knew him when he was a child. I think he was the 13th Dalai Lama was very fond of him. And when I was a young boy, I used to play with him. He had a mole on his lips. And so I received once from Trishma Rinpoche, and I do not know from whom Dundup Tundu had received it, probably from the 13th Dalai Lama. So the title of this text is called Entering into the Bodhisattva Way of Life. In the Indian language it's called Bodhicharya. In the Indian language it's called Bodhisattva Charya Vara. In the Tibetan language it's called Chandrasana Chabalan Chukwa. and in Tibetan language, we have more than 100 volumes, which were all translated from India, from Sanskrit, and then we have more than 225 volumes, which were also translated from Sanskrit, from Indian language. So apart from just a few texts, all of this is more than 300 precious texts and huge communities. They were all translated directly from Indian language. And from here we can see that how far-sighted our great Indian our great Tibetan kings and translators, and they were very open-minded and far-sighted. They were looking around towards their neighbors and trying to adopt the good things from their neighbors, and they were therefore not narrow-minded. So starting from the 33rd king, and then later through the presence of the three, the Dharma king, the abbot Shantarakshita, and the master Guru Pema Sambhava, then the work of translating all these texts got translated. And the kings and masters of that, Tibetan masters of that time were open and practical in the sense that they found it will be much more easier and more reliable to get the text directly translated from Indian language rather than have it translated from a Chinese source. And at that time, they also developed the confidence that Tibetans will be able to get all this translated, and that the Tibetans will be able to preserve all this religion and culture in the Tibetan language itself. And they were far-sighted in the sense that right at that time they started all those translation works, so that later on the Tibetan students and scholars will not have to rely on a different language, but they can study all this profound vast texts in the Tibetan language itself. And at that time we had different places, certain places which were devoted for translation, and there were certain places for meditation. So both during the first advancement of the Buddha Dharma in Tibet and also during the later advancement of the Buddha Dharma in Tibet, all these texts, relevant texts like Tripitaka and so on, got translated into Tibetan language. And then the subsequent translators also reviewed some of the past translations. So these are wonderful examples and great contributions. So since originally these texts were translated from Indian source, therefore in order to show the authenticity of the source and also to appreciate the great translators, so right in the beginning, in the opening of Tibetan text, it will always be in Indian language. So here also we have this Indian language saying Bodhisattva Charya Avatara, that means entering into the race and life of our Bodhisattva. So this title in general shows the title of the text. Sometimes the title of the text can be in terms of the content or the subject matter of the text. Sometimes the title of the text could carry the name of the master. For example, we have Buddhapalita. So Buddhapali is the name of the master who composed the text. So the name of the text is also called Buddhapalita. And then we have texts like Entering the Middle Way. It is called Entering the Middle Way because the main content is the Madhyamika viewpoint. The Indian word Bodhi has two levels of connotation. It on the one hand refers to the purification of all the shortcomings, faults and mental defilements, and on the other hand it also highlights the internalization of all the positive qualities. So this word Changchub refers to the state of enlightenment or omniscience or Buddhahood. So Buddhahood refers to a state which on the one hand has removed all the faults and shortcomings, and on the other hand actualized all the positive qualities. So in this way, this Indian word Bodhi has been very beautifully translated into this Tibetan word, true Tibetan word Changchub, which conveys the state of purification as well as the state of actualization of the positive qualities. So it speaks about purification of all those factors which are responsible for suffering, which are responsible for disturbance, and it also explains the development and actualization of all the positive qualities, all the virtues, all the realizations. And in fact, this word Bodhi or Changchub could refer to Sarvakas, the state of enlightenment of Sarvakas, state of enlightenment of Pratita Buddhas and Bodhisattva. Bodhisattva, Sattva refers to someone who has developed a mind aspiring to achieve that state of purification and enlightenment, that aspires to achieve that state of enlightenment. And so therefore on the one hand you have wisdom which targets and which focuses on the ultimate state of enlightenment, aspires to enlightenment, and as we discussed earlier, all types of grosser and subtler levels of this process of reality, they all can be eliminated once you fully understand the meaning of view of emptiness. And it is from this point we say that it is the wisdom that focuses on the complete state of enlightenment. It focuses on the state of cessation of all types of afflictive emotions. So it is through understanding the ultimate reality, the lack of inherent existence of all phenomena, that we can achieve enlightenment. So that's the meaning of wisdom focusing on enlightenment. And compassion focuses on sentient beings. Because you would aspire to enlightenment for the sake of sentient beings, when you have the compassion that shows concern to the well-being of all suffering sentient beings. So therefore, on the one hand, you have this compassionate motivation that takes into consideration the well-being of suffering sentient beings. On the other hand, you develop wisdom that gains true insight into the need to have an omniscient state of mind. And here we need tremendous courage, tremendous spirit. Without such tremendous resolution and courage, how could you develop such a mind that aspires to help all suffering sentient beings, that aspires to remove all their sufferings and to have them meet with all happiness? So when you commit yourself saying that I will commit myself to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings, you need to be tremendous courage and resolution, and the view of emptiness, the wisdom understanding emptiness, of course, is extremely important as an important factor for achieving enlightenment. But even more important than that is the altruistic wish to achieve enlightenment for the sake of all sentient beings. Now, in the case of the ways of life of such a bodhisattva, with regard to the practices that must be done by such a bodhisattva, there are three types of way of life. One is engaging way of life, which refers to development of two types of bodhisattva aspirations. So these two minds are the ones which will actually activate you and provoke you to enter into such a way of life, and influenced by such an altruistic wish, in terms of actual practice, you undertake the practice of the six perfections, and this is called the way of life in terms of practice, because that is the actual method, the path that you adopt, that you practice. And motivated by such a bodhisattva and leading such a way of life, and you finally actualize the enlightenment or Buddhahood, which is called the resultant way of life, the resultant conduct. So therefore you have these three kinds of way of life, the engaging, the motivating, the engaging, and the result. So in this text it explains about how to develop these two kinds of bodhicitta, then how to actually implement the ways of life of bodhisattva, and then finally what kind of result you will achieve. And in order to know how to practice them, you must study the text. Then the Tibetan Dharma kings at that time also passed a decree saying that depending upon which of the text belongs to which of the three Pitakas, a suitable process of paying homage should be done. So here also the translator pays homage to Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, indicating that this text belongs to the Sutta Pitaka. And then the first verse, first two lines starts by saying, which is paying homage, it says, I pay homage to the Buddhas and the Dharmas that they possess, and their children, and all those that are objects of reverence. And then the next two lines is making a promise to compose the text, which reads, in order to enter into the summary of way of life of the bodhisattvas, I will explain this in accordance with the text in a short way. And then in the next line she says, I have nothing to say here which has not been said before, and I have no beautiful compositions to offer to you, and therefore I really do not think that this will benefit to others, and I have composed this simply to make my mind habituated with this practice. And and in order to make my mind meditate and get habituated with the religious practices, and in order to develop my faith, I compose this text.
And probably later on, if some others who are of similar disposition like me, if they see this text, they might also be benefited. So the first two lines is paying homage, which is paying homage to Buddha Dhamma and Sangha. The homage is paid to Buddha, which is the Tathagata, and then to Dharma, which is possessed by the Buddhas.
So Dharma here primarily refers to the Mahayana Dharma, and the children, son refers to Bodhisattvas who have achieved the path of seeing, and these are the uncommon objects of reference. And then the next line is, I pay homage to all others who are worthy of paying the homage, like the Sarvaka Arhats and Pratika Buddha Arhats, and similarly ordinary practitioners, and similarly those who may have not entered into any spiritual path but who are like aborts or preceptors. And similarly, holy images, scriptures, and stupas, which represent the mind of the Buddha. And in this way, I pay homage to all that are worthy of paying the homage. Now, what do we mean by the epithet Tathagata, one who has entered into peace, one who entered into the bliss? The Indian or Sanskrit word is called Sugata. Su is something that is good, something that is peaceful. Gata means one who born into the state of peace. And this has been very exactly translated into Tibetan by the word Deshik. The word De means Su, something that is peaceful, something that is full of bliss. And Shik is one who has gone into that state of peace and bliss. So this refers to the Buddha. Now, even in the case of a Bodhisattva who has directly realized selflessness, through such a realization of selflessness, such a Bodhisattva such a Bodhisattva who has realized selflessness, for them, from their perspective, those people who accept self, presence of partless, permanent, all-pervading self is a misconception of the reality, as is said by Tongkhapa in his Press to the Defendant Arising, because such a view of grasping of self leads to development of suffering, leads to development of misconception. So therefore, such a misconception is not proper, and because it produces all types of afflictive emotions, and the result of afflictive emotions like old age, sickness, death, and so on. And on the other hand, when you follow a path which understands the selflessness of all phenomena, then you are able to remove not only the ignorance, which is the root cause of samsara, but you can also remove the seeds of such ignorance. And particularly at the state of enlightenment, you remove even the imprints of such ignorance, and thus you reach a state where you have totally actualized the omniscience, and you have entered into such a state of peace, such a state of bliss. That's the meaning of Tathagata. And also, as is said in the Bodhicharanavatara, that if you think about meditating on the attractive practices of loving kindness and compassion, how could you ever get time? Now, even in an ordinary case, look at the relation between a mother and a child. The child may not be so attractive or not so beautiful, maybe quite physically a little bit ugly, but still because of the affection, the mother sees the child as something very attractive, something very close to her heart. And now if you look at the love and compassion that the Buddha has to all other seven beings, then that love and compassion cannot be compared by the love and compassion that the mother has to her beloved child. And when you are able to appreciate such qualities, such practices, then of course naturally you will develop so much appreciation to develop such qualities, and therefore there is no way you can get tired, you can become lazy. And it is in fact amazing that we have such a human life, such human influence by which one can develop such attractive qualities like love and kindness and compassion. And these qualities like love and compassion are called attractive and pleasant because that they give us mental satisfaction, that they relax us, our mind, make us peaceful and tranquil. And I'm not saying that I have much realization, but I think this is true. And when you develop love and compassion, you develop tremendous kind of determination and courage. If you are able to develop such a loving and compassion towards all other sentient beings, then you are really a hero, you are really a great person. But unfortunately today, if you become a war hero, then people call that person as a hero. And in the Bodhicharavatara text, it says that killing other beings is not brave, because you are killing those who are sooner or later going to die. So it's really like trying to kill a dead body. So on the other hand, if you are able to develop such qualities like love and compassion, which thinks not only just yourself and your relatives, but all sentient beings, then you need tremendous kind of courage and spirit. Then you are really brave. You are really a hero. And in our human life, we experience much ups and downs because of experience of happiness and suffering. Now, if you are a great practitioner, one who has the right attitude, then when you experience happiness, you will not get too excited, you will not burst out, because you will be able to see and appreciate this happiness as a result of your virtuous practices, as a result of your having helped others. You will appreciate it and you will encourage yourself more to undertake such virtuous practices. And even if you encounter such sufferings, you will not discourage it, but you will be able to see such sufferings in the form of physical body, mental pains. You will be able to see that there is no way I should complain to others. These physical and mental sufferings that I am encountering are a result of my own unhealthy attitude. This is a result of my past life's misdeeds. So you should think that through experiencing such suffering, may I be able to purify my negative deeds. May through such experience, may I be able to reduce the suffering of other sentient beings. This is the attitude you will be able to attain. So even when you are successful, everything is on the right track, you will not get proud, you will not get arrogant, you will still be able to appreciate it, and that will encourage you to undertake more virtuous practices. And also on those occasions when you experience problems and sufferings, you will not get discouraged. Now these two experiences of happiness and suffering, these are the two things which brings too much ups and downs in the human life. Now if you know how to handle and face such situations, such a person will never experience any problems or sufferings. And in this way, such a person will be able to transfer and move from peace to peace, from light to light, from happiness to unhappiness. And as is said by Nagarjuna in his precious Gallant, and when you are mentally happy, time doesn't play any role. And when you are mentally unhappy, even a short duration is unbearable. So therefore it is said that in the case of a bodhisattva, because of the great practice of wisdom, great practice of elders, even if they keep on going, undertaking a lot of hardships, physical and mental, for many lives, for many eons, they never get tired, because they are totally determined, and they know their objectives, and they know how to maintain a proper attitude. And because of wisdom, because of skillful methods, because of certain mental qualities, even those misfortunes and calamities can be transformed into the spiritual path, and these misfortunes and calamities will not become hindrance and obstruct, and therefore time is not important. And therefore I always pray by reciting these four line words where I say, as long as space remains, as long as sufferings of sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel their sufferings. So right from the beginning, all your practices are devoted to the well-being of yourself and other sentient beings. And while on the path, you enter into such a practice, and finally you achieve enlightenment. So you travel from peace to peace, from happiness to happiness. So there is no occasion for you to get lazy or discouraged. And this, I think, is absolutely true. So that's the meaning of Sugata, Tathagata. And it is this Tathagata who possesses the Dharmakaya, the Dharma body. So Dharmakaya here refers to the Dharma, which is a state of a level of two states of purification. This Dharmakaya possesses the natural purity as well as the state of purification from temporary defilements. Now, this natural quality refers to the state of presence of the lack of inherent existence or emptiness. And it is because of this presence of lack of inherent existence of all phenomena, because of interdependence, that it is possible to remove the temporary defilements. So, Dharmakaya. So this Dharmakaya refers to again to the state of the Buddhahood. And this mind of the Buddha, this very subtle mind of the Buddha, which possesses such a Dharmakaya, which is also called ever goodness or Samantabhadra, this mind is the basis of such subtle emptiness, and this mind is called the wisdom truth body. And this wisdom truth body is actualized for the benefit of other sentient beings, so that one can, because this Dharmakaya is a body which is actualized through prayers and wishes to be able to abide forever, to be of benefit to countless sentient beings. And it is this Dharmakaya which emanates itself in the form of a living person as the Buddha to help sentient beings whose minds are not transformed and enlightened. And the Dharma here refers to also to the Mahayana Dharma of the true cessation and the true path. And likewise, the children, which here refers to the Bodhisattvas, who possess such qualities. And so I pay homage to them, the Buddha Dharma Sangha, and all those that are worthy of paying homage. Next two lines read, in order to enter into a summary practice of all the Bodhisattva sons or Bodhisattva children, I will make a short or concise presentation in accordance with the teaching of the Buddha. Now, the summary here means an explanation which, this is called summary because it explains in entirety the whole practice of way of life of Bodhisattva, right from the beginning, when you think about how to develop the Bodhicitta, and then later to the development of omniscience. So, in short, the summary of Bodhisattva way of life is the three moral, three ethical disciplines of a bodhisattva. Now, if you are undertaking such a sort of summary of a bodhisattva, then since there are so many words of the Buddha and so many commentaries, how are you going to explain this? Then this is answered by Sanjidhava by saying that I am not fabricating something new, but I will explain this in a concise way in accordance with the sutra. Now, if again you can ask a question by saying, if you are explaining in accordance with the sutra, then it is just repetition, then why you are writing this? Then this he answers by saying, yes, it is in accordance with the sutra in terms of authenticity, but I am summarizing it so that you can easily understand it. And then in the next lines, Shantideva says that I have nothing to offer here which has not been explained before. So this has a very profound meaning again. Shantideva is saying that if you are reading my text just for the sake of getting some new information, then I have no new information to offer. But if you are not seeking just information, but you are here for practice, and then he is saying implicitly that I have things to offer. So normally our tendency is really to look for new information. And so he's saying that if you are you belong to someone who is really looking for new words and new informations, and you are looking just for new things and not for transforming your mind, then he says, I have really nothing much to offer. And then in the second line he says, even if the meaning is same, but if you have a wonderful ways of composing the text, it's very poetic and so on, then again it will be very interesting reading. And so he's saying that if you are those who are attracted to the beauty of the words, beauty of the composition, then he says, I have no beautiful compositions to offer here. Then he's saying that again, so he's in a way highlighting the faults of the practitioners, the listeners. And therefore, I have no wish, I do not think that this will benefit others. And then he says, I have composed this to be of benefit to myself. And so implicitly he is saying that even if the subject matter is the same, but if you are those who want to practice, then since it is important to make your mind habituated with the teaching again and again, therefore my composition will help you. Because until you achieve enlightenment, you need to read, meditate such as 100 times, 1,000 times. And therefore there is one text which says that even if you are a superior being, an Arya who has achieved the third spiritual ground, you should not be satisfied with hearing. And also it is said that do not rely on the interpretive teaching, but on the ultimate teaching. Now in terms of the beauty of the word and composition, as we have already read, the maintaining like the rays of the sun, there also the grammar is also so, and the beauty of composition is also not something special, but it has a beautiful meaning. So if you are not those who are simply looking for beauty of the word and composition, and you are really someone who is looking for the meaning, then he is saying that there is something to offer here, and you are a suitable disciple, and you can get benefited from here. So we'll stop here today.